Hello, everyone, and welcome from here in the capital city of Austin, Texas. This is Capital Geek, a podcast dedicated to the founders and operators that create the products we love and turn them into fabulous companies with meaningful exits. Whether you're raising your first round of capital or racing toward an IPO, this is where we deep dive on the lessons learned from seasoned industry veterans, geeks of all types, the experts leading product and engineering teams, operations and finance, or sales and marketing, and we'll both learn from their mistakes and celebrate their successes while providing a roadmap for you to accelerate your own journey toward success. My name is Josh Stevens, CTO at Elsewhere Partners, and I am the Capital Geek. In this episode, we'll talk with the great and powerful Pradeep Itticharia, Chief Technology Officer at Kasasa. Kasasa provides advanced technologies to empower community and regional banks to offer the same high-tech products and services as large multinational banks, but with the personalized touch that fuels the customer loyalty that makes local banks so popular. Pradeep is going to share with us his lessons learned and best practices for introducing and advancing artificial intelligence as a part of your product strategy and roadmap. I can't wait to learn more. So, without further ado, here's this week's episode of Capital Geek. Today I have with me in the studio my friend and colleague, Pradeep Itticharia. Thank you for coming.
Happy to be here. Excited.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because every time I talk to you, you seem a little bit more excited than last time I saw you. And that isn't common, you know, nowadays around as busy as we are in technology. I'd love to know sort of, you know, more than what we read on your bio, what you've been working on lately and what has you so excited about what we're seeing in our industry.
Absolutely. It's not often that you get to work at a company that's saving an industry. Last couple of years, I've been with Kasasa, and we are helping community banks beat the mega banks. And it's been an exciting journey. We're giving them the tools and the products to compete with the big boys, and they're winning. And so it's really amazing, all the work we've been doing there.
It must be a pretty powerful feeling to be the company that gives the bat to the little guy being picked on by a bully that lets them beat him off and sustain their livelihood, right?
Absolutely, and that too, a pretty big bet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
it's a bet that the big guys have that is very hard for the community banks to get, both in terms of products and services. And we do it at scale. We work with 900 institutions, and we do it with tangible results. You know, these products are driving profitable accounts at these institutions. Our marketing programs are driving acquisition rates that are better than any of the large financial institutions. And we're doing it with technologies that are only available to the very largest institutions. They're both driven off data science, a lot of third-party data that we bring in and curate, really leverage the network of these institutions to provide the scale that otherwise they would have no chance of having.
Well, I'm a big fan. Personally, I've been trying to move to a community bank for years, but wasn't able to because they didn't have, you know, the appropriate web services I needed. Their bill pay, you know, web services and APIs weren't very developed. But after meeting with you, I went and found a community bank that uses Kasasa, and I've been super happy with them. And so now I have the best of both worlds. I have a local bank with a business card with someone's name, and I know I can walk over to her desk and talk to her. At the same time, I have the big bank, you know, online presence, style, technologies, and tools. So it's fantastic.
I'm glad it's been a great experience for you. Josh, what is really interesting is we've done a lot of market research, as you can imagine. When we talk to consumers, 9 out of 10 consumers, and we have the data to prove this, would bank with a community bank if they believe they had the same products and services that the large institutions have. Why is that? They like the service they get from a community bank. There's something nice about being able to know who your banker is. Even if you don't go into the branch every week, it's good to know you can pick up the phone and talk to somebody real. The challenge always is the products and the services, that especially the technologies that they have that they can make available. And companies like us, like Kasasa, help them get those products and services. And so it's the best of both worlds. It's the personalized service you'd expect from your small community bank with the technologies that only the largest have.
Well, that's fantastic.
Absolutely. Last couple of years, we've been trying to save community banking, right? Community banking is an integral part of the U.S. economy, and I don't think a lot of people realize, but I think something like 40% of all small business loans come from community banks. So what I've been doing, working with an amazing company here in Austin called Kasasa, is really trying to give community banks and credit unions the tools they need to compete with the mega banks. And we've been having fun doing it and a lot of success.
It seems that in your role, you've been exposed to a wide plethora of technologies because you guys are sort of a technology broker or enablement platform for these community banks. What are some of the hottest technologies you're seeing sort of continue to circulate, you know, recursively through the flow?
Absolutely. So banking tech, you know, legacy banking tech is not the most exciting in terms of technology advancements. But what has happened over the last couple of years is just the amazing proliferation of data technologies, right? Not just, you know, machine learning and AI, but also just predictive analytics with good data infrastructure in place. And so what I'm getting really excited about is finally that banks and community banks are actually appreciating the value of data. And instead of it being seen as something they want to hold on to and just kind of worry about risk, not always thinking about it in the right way, they've actually become way more open to actually sharing data with the right partners to bring more value to their customers. And that's something that you would not have thought of in banking a couple of years back.
You know, I think that you're alluding to this this trend we've seen in the marketplace around data ops,
right?
Where people are making it a more formal part of the business, where you're collecting, collating, in some cases translating data to get it into some common data lake, where you could use a BI tool like Tableau or Looker to dive deeper down. Is that similar to what you're seeing out there?
So what you see is you see two kinds of companies. Companies that are trying to leverage a data technology stack from a company like Kasasa, and then companies that are actually running their own technology around data. And in both cases, yes, a big aspect of leveraging all the value out of data, whether it's through an analytical platform, is to make sure that you actually have some kind of a data ops operation, as you called out. Data quality is a big challenge. And if you want to do anything meaningful with data, you tend to start thinking about data volumes, you know, a high degree of data. And as soon as you start getting into those kind of higher data volumes, data quality becomes paramount, right? And a lot of companies don't tend to focus or invest in that. They tend to focus on technologies to do ETL. They tend to bring data into, as you said, into a database, into a lake, into a reservoir, even if it's not going into a final data warehouse. But the focus is always around technologies trying to get data in, data enablement. But where it falls apart is not having the right rigor, just like you would have with software development. You know, not having the right rigor around how you manage that data, that whole life cycle, whether it's data quality, whether it's data operations, scalability. And so we are seeing a lot of advancements there, both from the infrastructure providers, like if you think about the public cloud providers, like an Amazon or a Microsoft, along with their data warehousing technologies and the database technologies, they're providing you tools to manage that data ops cycle. But then you also see some very specialized companies that are providing capabilities around data ops. And so we've seen both. We leverage both. And it's an exciting time. I think what's happening is you finally have the tools to be able to not worry about the plumbing and start focusing more on where the value really comes in with the data, which is the analytics and everything else after that.
That's pretty fascinating because the plumbing can be the whole project if you're not careful. Having been through, you know, some of these big data lake, data warehouse projects myself, it tends to be the thing that people don't focus enough time on. What's invigorating to me is that it seems that a lot of different parts of the company are adopting what probably started in DevOps, but now you're seeing DevOps, SecOps, NetOps, AI Ops, data ops. In some cases, you'll see revenue operations.
Right.
And I think what that's allowing us to do is to build playbooks and be more prescriptive about how to manage that part of the business, especially now that we have good data, right? And so step one, I guess, would be, you know, build a data ops strategy and pipeline so you always have good data. Along that path, customers will likely, you know, begin to experience their first work with a data scientist, either an employee or a contractor. And at some point, they're going to ask about AI and ML. That seems like a natural evolution. But I want to back up just a second because I think what we just talked about is that a good path for many companies would be to focus on data ops first, right? Because if your data is no good, and your models are no good, then your AI is going to be very painful if useful at all. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I always think about it like it's almost like a pyramid, right? So if you start off at even before you start getting into predictive analytics, machine learning, almost everybody does some kind of historical reporting, correct? That's the first thing that you see in banks. You see it in any company. You have to be able to report on historical facts and what happened. So if you first think about just getting your data infrastructure in place, even before you start thinking about data ops, first of all, get an inventory of where your data is, first party, second party, and third party, right? Where is this data coming from? Is it reliable? Is it consistent? Start thinking about then the operations around it. So whether it is you know, how are you thinking about ETL? Is it truly something that's scalable? Are you thinking about it like your CI/CD, your continuous integration, your continuous deployment streams? Are you using a technology stack like Airflow or something where you're trying to bring all these jobs together, right? So step one is, how do I get the data in, and how do I do it in a way that is scalable, and what tooling do I need to put around it? Even before what you decide about what you're going to do with that data. What we see, for example, in the industry that I'm in right now, historical reporting has been around forever. You need it for regulatory purposes. And then and all you're trying to do with historical reporting is trying to answer the question as to what happened. But then very immediately, as soon as that data comes in and people get excited about that data, the next thing they want to talk about is, so why is this happening? So they want to start doing ad hoc analysis, right? And then as soon as you start answering some questions about why is this happening, then they want to know what's going to happen next. And that's when you start getting into predictive analytics. And they're not happy with just that, then they want to start thinking about what's the best that can happen, right? That's where you start thinking about scoring and what the next best action engine is. That's where truly the value of predictive analytics comes in. Now, all these things can be done without any machine learning or any AI, right? But to get these things done, you need not even data scientists. You need somebody who can work with statistics. And in a lot of our analytics, predictive analytics, there's so much untapped value in good old-fashioned predictive analytics before you even start hitting the realm of the needs of machine learning and then deep learning and everything else that goes beyond that, right? But to get to all that foundation, to your point early on, you have to have the right infrastructure in place. You need to have something that's scalable. You need to think about data as an asset, not data as a technology. So I always think about data as a product. That's the way I talk about it in my company. In every company I've been at, we have a product manager around data, which is, instead of it being just something that you treat as a utility that you turn a tap on and you expect data to come out, you think of it as a product and you put a roadmap around it.
So you mentioned ETL a couple times. For listeners that may not be familiar with what that is or how it fits in that life cycle, maybe you could just briefly cover that.
Sure. So when you think about data, you got to first extract data from its source. That source could be a database that's in your own organization. It could be a partner that's providing you data. Once you've extracted that data, that data is probably not going to conform to any structure that you understand in your business. So you've got to transform that data. And that's the T in the ETL. For both extracting the data and for transforming the data, there are many technologies. It's something that we've been doing for many decades. And then finally, you've got to load that transformed data into something that becomes your enterprise store. It could be a database, it could be a warehouse, it could be something in between. And so that's where really kind of putting a good discipline around extraction, transformation, and loading of data serves you well as you start going up that chain I was talking about.
So far we've been talking about the leveraging of data ops and AI to a lesser extent, but focus specifically on, you know, organizations that would do this as part of their core business, you know, enterprise organizations, mid-market companies. Let's stick with that line of thought for a moment before we switch to something else. For those organizations, what would be a good way for them to either create a scorecard for themselves to figure out where they are in this life cycle, whether they're ready to be thinking about basic ETL and data warehousing, or maybe they should be thinking more about predictive analytics? How can they assess their capabilities and know where to start?
Right. There are two ways to kind of answer that question. First is to try and identify what is driving your data journey, right? Are you using data and analytics for answering business questions that support your enterprise business? Or are you using it to actually productize something, as in sell it in a product or a service? Depending on that answer, you're going to take two different journeys to how you get there. If you're using data as an enabler for your business, but that's it, stops at the boundary, at the doors of your business, you're using it to maybe get more operational efficiency in a certain area of your business. Well, when you look at data in that context, you are basically trying to make sure that when you think about how you structure your data, how you bring it together, you are not thinking about scale in the context of productizing that data. So you're thinking about more in terms of integrations, for example. You're saying, okay, I need to make sure that my data feeds that talk about how is my sales pipeline doing, those data feeds are integrating well with my Salesforce CRM solution. And so really, depending on how you are going to use that data, you have to really look at what that journey will be. What I see is a lot of enterprises that are actually using data as an internal asset, they tend to focus on integrations. They tend to focus on integrations with their existing technology stack or the application stack. So what you typically have in those organizations is you'll see a business process management team, a BPM team, that probably was responsible for rolling out their ERP, their CRM solution, or their sales forecasting solution, or for that matter, their project management solution. That team will try to find out that it can integrate with these data sources to add more value. Where also what you see out there is that a lot of those technologies have amazing analytics capabilities. Now, if you think about something like Salesforce, they have an entire analytical platform within Salesforce, but it requires data that is not sitting in Salesforce. So the focus in those kinds of projects is all about integration. Now, what I get more excited about sometimes is how data gets productized as an offering that's going to actually affect your top and your bottom line. And that's where it gets interesting, because that's when you start thinking about data as a product, right? So then you start thinking about capabilities that actually give you a differential advantage versus competition. Case in point, at Kasasa, we actually leverage data to run marketing programs for our institutions. We work with about 900 financial institutions. And the difference between our marketing programs and, say, maybe a marketing program that's being done by a company that just does marketing for somebody is we leverage millions of records of data to know what the right targeting model is. So that journey is different, because now we look at data from a scale perspective, from a governance perspective, because now there is dollars and cents involved in what could go wrong if the data isn't properly managed. So I think from a technology perspective, in both cases, you need to have a strong foundation of how the data comes in and gets integrated. But then what happens next depends on what those two outcomes are. Is it used for internal purposes or for productizing something?
So if I were the CTO at a mid-market or enterprise company, mm-hmm. and my boss, the board of directors, somebody has said, we need to have an AI story. We need to be able to answer that question in a way that pleases analysts and investors. Even though the roadmap may not be calling for it yet, we need an answer for it. We need something. Now, what would be, an easy or a good jumping off point for a traditional enterprise company to sort of dip their toe in the water as it relates to AI?
That's a great question. I think a lot of companies try to do it from scratch. And even try to put a roadmap together, even if they just wanted to have a story, right? There is a lot of maturity now in terms of reusable AI platforms that truly give you a little bit of a plug-and-play capability. So for example, let's say you're a mid-market company in warehousing, retail warehousing. You will, with platforms like Naeem and a few other technologies out there, you can literally get hundreds of AI models that will plug in well into your industry and are just waiting for data to be connected to those models. So if I'm putting a plan together, both for the management team, for the investor, and for the market, I'd be basically looking at what's there in the industry right now. Should I build versus buy around the core platforms that I'm going to use? What kind of skill sets do I need? Can I upskill my existing BI team, or existing research team? In many cases, those teams have skill sets such as R and such as other statistical tools, but they may not have machine learning skills. And again, the gap there can be filled with the right amount of training. And so I would basically definitely look at two aspects of this. What kind of skill sets do I need? Do I have the right team? And also, am I building versus buying? And if I am buying, then where do I need to invest? Do I need to build some purposeful models that give me some kind of an IP differential versus everybody else has the same model, then what's the big difference? What's unique about our products in this space that those models don't serve? And how can I extend those models? There's some open source models now that can be leveraged. So I think there's a lot of maturity in the space right now. A couple of years back, you would be doing everything from scratch. These would be huge investments. I think now you can work with vendors, you can use the open source space, and really get a good head start.
That's a great answer. If you were advising other enterprises and mid-market companies, you know, all of your banks and other companies, on how to deal with their software vendors on the subject of AI. You know, I'm debating buying a tool. The tool does something interesting. It could be, you know, online billing or warehousing or CRM or whatever. And, you know, we noticed there's no AI in the roadmap, and we're kind of curious if they're thinking down those lines. Like, what would you advise me as a buyer to question that vendor about and how?
So one of the things, you find a lot of general purpose AI vendors now. You know, if you're not familiar with AI, you tend to kind of look at all models as the same. You see everything as a statistical exercise. The first question I'll ask the vendor is, one, do you understand my domain? Do you understand my industry? Are you expecting my teams to use your baseline models and extend them? Or are you just giving me an empty platform that I use to build things? Those are all important questions, because based on that, you'll know what kind of effort's involved. There are some very industry-specific AI models, vendors. You really need to understand how well they know the industry. But actually, it goes a little beyond that. There's a lot of generalities in industries also. Just because you have a forecasting model for retail, do you have a forecasting model, machine learning forecasting model for fast-moving consumer good retail? No, you don't. So then it's not no good just giving me a retail model. It's that level of detail you need to start looking at. Again, depending on, are you willing to build a team that's going to then invest in AI and machine learning and the skill sets around that, or are you looking for something off the shelf? And those are going to be two different levels of rigor when you kind of look at those vendors.
Pradeep, what piqued your interest in these technologies specifically?
It's the beauty of the network effect. So again, I'm a little anchored towards my experiences of the last 5-6 years. So when you work with close to about 1,000 institutions, each of those institutions by themselves don't have enough scale, both in terms of size and in terms of the amount of data they have access to, right? So they could have the smartest data scientists in their shop, but they just don't have the volume of data to make something that's meaningful and repeatable. And so the beauty of AI, let's not even use AI, the beauty of data science is that it's a very democratic process once you start getting access to scale. And so any industry that can benefit from a network effect, a network of institutions in our case, let's say it's a social, it's a business in social media, well, the access to the combined user bases of a Facebook and a Google, that scale makes these models way more effective. And for many years, it was always about, we won't have enough data. We won't have enough variability in our data, so we won't have good models. Now that people have realized that the IP, intellectual property, is not so much in the model, it's in what you do with the model. So now they're getting a little more open to sharing across a network. And that has made this whole thing more exciting. It's no longer just conversation about technologies. It's a conversation about what's the business value that's coming out, and are we willing to work with everybody else in the industry to get better results for everybody? And that's really that has changed. I think what's happened is there's a lot more data democratization over the last couple of years. People are getting comfortable sharing data as long as they can get value back and then can leverage that for something that's unique to them.
I found that to be true as well. I might add one caveat, in that it is easier when you're dealing with businesses that for some reason have some sort of a competitive moat between them. In many cases with regional banks, it might be geography, right? But there could be other reasons where those moats exist that would make you more and more comfortable with sharing data of that type. But I think it's a real challenge, right? I mean, if you back way up, right, to early cloud adopters, the concern was that, is my data private? Is my data secure? Can I really have devices running, my workloads outside my building? we migrated from that to, you know, colo facilities and MSPs, from there to public cloud. And public cloud has then now evolved to mean many, many different things. But I think that we've just gradually become less attached to our data. You know, we're more open about it being out there. We're more realistic about the fact that we're probably not the only ones with it anyway.
Right.
And so the data in itself is not nearly as valuable as the insights you might gain from the data through some data science. It's been a common thread that I've seen in other avenues as well. What's fascinating, though, about what you're doing is because you're focused on a specific industry and, you know, companies that look somewhat similar, you know, it gives you a tremendous advantage in the space. You know, as an investor, when we're doing diligence and, you know, we're looking right now for companies in these spaces to invest in, you know, the challenge is that most of the companies doing AI, in any form of AI or AI ops, or even sometimes data ops, they're either a very generic toolbox, for lack of a better term, that you could build yourself a really nice smart car with, if you know what you're doing, or they are, you know, a services catalog, and you're going to pay them to come in and custom do something for you based upon a very, very small amount of probably open source, you know, code in the middle. And there aren't many people that are sort of getting past that point because the tools, as you said, are pretty generic. You know, the models are lacking. But I think companies like you, you know, are moving that forward very, very rapidly. And if we can see that happen in your market and someone else does it in an adjacent market, maybe for farming or agriculture, and someone else does it for, you know, I don't know, pick a space, hopefully these models will begin to evolve and maybe we'll see some rapid escalation of some things, especially, like, for example, another one of our companies we invested in is called Burst IQ, and they're a blockchain-based health records management platform. But what's fascinating about what they're doing is because it's blockchain-based, you know, you're able to grant, you know, many millions of records to specific researchers and scientists, withholding the data that the customer or the patient in this case feels, you know, uncomfortable with giving out. And with data sets like the ones we're building right now, and I know Larry Ellison also funded a project out in LA that talking about, you know, these problems of solving a cancer or a COVID-19 or, you know, any of the other things that are plaguing us seem a lot more comfortable when we start to aggregate that work.
Absolutely, yeah. That's interesting. You know, it's kind of funny. What was precious a couple of years back is customers are not that worried about it. I don't know if you remember, there was a period in the early 2000s when shredders were big. People were buying big shredding machines. And every piece of mail they got in the mail, you know, they would shred it, even if it was junk mail, because they didn't want the address out. Well, 20 years later, our address, our names, our date of births, you can search them and you can find that out. So what's also happening is as consumers are getting more comfortable about, you know, what is safe and what's not, at least based on their current understanding, they're open to sharing a lot more. Even HIPAA, when you look at HIPAA and the HIPAA regulations, when they were first written, they were tighter, right?
Yeah,
because they were just concerned about
they've relaxed themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that is a natural evolution of how customers start getting more comfortable when they start seeing value. The challenge is when they don't see that value, then they don't want to share more. And the same thing, you can translate that to business too. In business, what's happening is, to your point, absolutely right. There are quite a few industries where you have the scale issue, where you have some incumbents who have a high degree of concentration. Banking is a great example. That, you know, the top four or five banks own about 90% of the market share. So the remaining 10% are thousands of institutions. They are trying to get that scale, and so that's, they get a little more eager to share, right? So the need drives the sharing. That's not the only industry. There are many industries where there's a high degree of concentration, and the remaining group needs some kind of network effect to come into play to get that same value that those incumbents have, the big ones have. So I think back to your original question about, you know, the difference between a very generic platform that doesn't really give you much value other than tools, and then something that is services-oriented, just a bunch of people writing machine learning models at the back end. You know, what's the happy part between that so that you can start adding this value to these industries that need that kind of that scale balance? I think it is a function of having the right tool set for sure, so that it actually makes life easier for anybody who's trying to do anything in this space. Because don't get me wrong, even these very generic tools are extremely valuable. They're doing some critical things around tasks that otherwise would take man hours and a lot of time, and they make it repeatable. So that is very valuable. I think if companies can pick a few industries that they're interested in, that they want to focus on, look for some industry dynamics like I was talking about, where there is this scale imbalance, and then invest in some, whether you want to call it starter kits or models that will give somebody in that industry a great starting point. And something where they can keep investing into the vendor, so that it's a constantly evolving library of capabilities, models.
But geared toward their business.
But geared towards their business. That's the key. That's the key. And I think there's tremendous. I mean, that's an untapped space altogether. What has happened, to your point, is a lot of investment in tooling, generic tooling, a bunch of services companies, and I think there's a sweet spot in the middle. The challenge is going to be finding the industries that have enough runway left. Where it makes sense to specialize in and still have a very viable business for the next 30 years.
It's pretty fascinating. You know, we talked a lot about users' digital privacy. You know, my right as an individual to have some sort of a modicum of privacy digitally. Personally, I think digital privacy is a complete farce and it doesn't really exist anymore. But people talk about it a lot and they focus on it. What I find is interesting is that in many cases when I talk to users, they are much more willing to share the data from their device, their computer, what they're working on, as opposed to the company, which in many cases hoards that data and tightly constrains who has access to a BI tool or a dashboard or, you know, in many cases, a lot of the people doing the work that would benefit from understanding that story could benefit even more if they had access to the data directly. Now, I know there's some movements around, you know, using blockchain-type technologies to lock down data and other token-based methodologies. You know, what have you seen around that? Have you seen it start to come forward, and what are you thinking there?
I think blockchain is fascinating for various reasons, one of them being permission ledgers, distributed ledgers. If you historically look at blockchain, a lot of use cases were ignored because it always came down to performance and speed. People were always trying to look at, hey, can we get a million nodes updating a ledger in real time, and then everybody gets access, and then, you know, the fastest protocols couldn't get it down below 5 or 6 seconds, right? And therefore, it negated the value of that solution for things like payments. I think distributed ledgers are fascinating, especially if they are permission ledgers with a few participants in it. And I go back to payments for an example. If you think about the need for the networks, Visa, MasterCard, Amex, and Discover, what do? They connect a bunch of last-mile point-of-sale terminals to issuing banks, right, through a network of participants. The top four issuers in this, credit card issuers in this country, I think own 70% of the market share. So the top four issuers, these top four banks, decided to have a distributed ledger that was connected. And they worked with the top three acquirers, companies that actually connect the merchant to this network. Those seven entities, four issuers, top three acquirers, they could probably manage 90% of the credit card transactions in this country through a distributed ledger at scale. Now, I'm sure the devil's in the details, and I don't want to minimize that. But the point, I think, is to your earlier point, I think there's a lot of value in distributed ledger technology. Blockchain is fascinating in that sense. The people tend to over-focus on the crypto side of things. Whether it's smart contracts, whether it's use cases in healthcare, there are many use cases out there. I think what you need is you need willing participants in the network. Again, this again comes back to cooperation between players in the network. And goes back to that whole thing of where do people think their value is? Are they hold on to this value. They hold on to sharing data. And they actually are willing to pay a middleman just because they want to keep that data sharing from somebody else. And they'd rather have this person in the middle or this entity in the middle. I think that's slowly changing. And I think when that does, I think a lot more use cases will open up for blockchain.
You know, when we were in the early days at SolarWinds, we built our own super CRM, you might say, that did some data modeling on the back end and some predictive analysis. And a brilliant young lady named Haley Euler built a system from scratch, just one of the smartest people I've ever worked with in my life. And what I remember about the system is that on the main page, when everyone logged in, this is everyone in the company, from the lady that, you know, sat down at the desk to put in an order to, you know, me as leading product or whomever, there was a dashboard that showed exactly how the company was doing by the minute, by the day, which deals came in, which deals hadn't come in, how things are trending, an amount of data that a lot of companies only show in a boardroom ever. And it was exposed to the entire company. And it gave us a real focus. It was a very interesting way for a company to run, where we all understood the goals and objectives and had an easy way of seeing that, you know, on a screen at our desk every day. And I haven't seen that repeated much, but I have seen a few companies doing some similar things. ActiveTrack here in town does something similar. And I've actually seen some of their customers using their product to put up a dashboard on their team's productivity and things they're working on. So I hope we're moving in that direction, but you know what I hope the listeners learn from this is that there is a lot of intrinsic value in enabling the people on your teams who can have access to the data to have access it. And if you're wondering if you know which of that data you can't restrict, or you're finding yourself scared about that, you know, talk to an expert, get some advice on it. But generally speaking, you know, your team is thinking about the problems that you're trying to solve much more frequently than you are, and give them access to the data, and they may surprise you with a great solution.
Absolutely. If I may add something there, and I've seen a few companies that have done that, where they really kind of make data very available to everybody in the company. One thing I do like to kind of do is get a good balance of data that represents activity versus data that represents outcomes. And I think sometimes, especially technology teams, they focus only on the activities, not so much on the outcomes. And then business functions sometimes tend to focus only on the outcomes. You know, yeah. Number of sales, contracts, that's an outcome. And it's getting that balance right, because both those pieces of information or ways of looking at data drive different behaviors in an enterprise.
Well, and without one or the other, you really don't any insight into what's going on.
That's right. And so I think even as vendors look at building tools, you know, enabling new capabilities using analytics, it's trying to get the right mix there, right? Trying to get both those things in here. So because, you know, I don't know who said that, but if you can't measure it, you can't improve it, right? Or you can't fix it. So, but then what are you measuring? Are you measuring the outcome? Are you measuring the activity? And you really need to balance that. And as a technology leader, I tend to kind of focus on both. I tend to skew a little bit more towards the outcomes, but you need to measure both.
Pradeep, we're just about out of time. Any last thoughts you want to share?
Well, first of all, thank you. This was good fun. Great.
Absolutely.
Fun. Always good talking about Sharp. I am extremely excited about. Someone just asked me this last week. You know, what keeps you excited about working where you're at Kasasa, and what do you want to do next? And I always get excited about the fact that there is so much untapped value in all the data we're sitting on. Doesn't matter what kind of a company you are, you've got data that in your enterprise that you're not leveraging. And you know what you can do with that, and really create new markets for yourself, or you know, or increase penetration in existing markets. Change your product strategies, leverage that data. And I think step one is to first identify what do you have, and then get someone who actually thinks about data as a product or a product capability, versus it just being an enabler for what you build. You know, your widget that you build or your software that you build.
So that person is that person. A product manager with some data science skills, or what's the DNA of that?
I think it's
special character look like.
That's a great question, and it is a challenge, because you know, when you look up data product manager, you know, just do a search in LinkedIn, you will see a lot of people are technology people who have now become data product managers. I actually would lean towards somebody who actually has a product management background,
yeah.
came from building products that leverage data, was a consumer of data.
But has some analytical skills.
Has some analytical skills. Yeah. If you can get a mix of both analytical skills and that's amazing. But I'm just excited about all the value that's sitting there that is untapped. And I'm just, you know, technologies around that and capabilities around that is a great place to look at, both from an investment perspective, but also just what do you want to do.
It's fascinating. I was asked the same question last week, you know, why I was excited to be here. And I think for me, in my role at Elsewhere Partners, What invigorates me most is just the massive opportunity we have to teach and empower the next set of leaders within these companies to then go off and lead the next set of companies and so forth. We have a super bright group of operating advisors and operators, and they fall into the same patterns that we see, you know, time after time. So as we put together our own sort of playbook to make that a little easier, like the exciting part for me is that as much as you see with data, I see these people also as, you know, they could all be CEOs someday and running companies successfully. So, but it only happens, right, when you have the right kind of leadership. And, you know, three big trends that we all talk about right now are, number one, the need to have data ops, right? And that kind of ties back to a trend of product teams and business managers saying, look, we need to make data-based decisions. We need to have real data, right? You tie that back to the fact that we are now in many companies escalating a product role, either a VP of product or a chief product officer or a chief strategy officer, sometimes a CTO, in the company to a level where that role is really thinking about the whole go-to-market effort for that entire line of business, soup to nuts with that product. And when you tie that together with what we're seeing around data sciences and AI, if you can add to that, we had a speaker on earlier this week, Andrew Call, who is a career-long chief customer officer type role. If you add to that the fact that many companies have now decided that one of their main focuses is ensuring customer success, true customer success, did their project succeed, and do we believe that might lead to a good outcome for us? But those three things to me really excite me in terms of just how software companies are being built and run and where we might go with it very quickly.
Right. Absolutely. And I think you hit it on the head. That's a great way of kind of putting it together. I think the final one is the thing that makes the most sense to me, which is delivering the product successfully is one thing, but making sure that the product is giving delivering consistent value that you can measure is going to bring back happy it's going to bring back happy customers, sticky customers. Is going to do wonders to your recurring revenue and is probably almost a given if you have any kind of a SaaS-based solution.
That's right.
Focus less on just the features that the product delivered and just kind of actually measure how that those products features are being used and how is it adding true value. You know, I kind of always say this, and I have somebody I work with who's super passionate, somebody who actually runs business intelligence for me, is just super passionate about how is the report actually being used. Forget about how cool the report looks. It's beautiful, right? It's got beautiful UX and UI. But he will measure how many people are using it, are they getting the answers they need, and what came out of those answers? What did those answers generate in terms of revenue? And you just don't see that in most technology people. And I'm so thrilled that he's on my team. But that's the kind of passion that someone needs when they're trying to complete that data journey.
That's fascinating. Pradeep, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. I especially want to thank you for coming by today and joining the podcast. I'm sure we'll have you on again. It's been great. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure. A lot of fun. Thank you.
That's it, everyone. And thank you for joining Capital Geek. Subscribe via Apple, Stitcher, or any platform where you usually find fantastic podcasts. Tune in again soon for another great episode of Capital Geek.